Ave, and welcome to Emperors of Rome, a Roman history podcast from La Trobe University. I'm your host, Matt Smith, and with me today is Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, a Research Fellow in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. This is episode CLXIV, Gordian III. When the dust settled on a six-month civil war in 238 CE, only the 13-year-old Gordian is left standing to take the purple. Once again, Rome is left with a teenage emperor. Here's Kaelin Davenport.
In January of 238, there is a crisis for Maximinus. The people of Africa revolt against his harsh tax exactions, and they march to Carthage, where they acclaim the elderly proconsul Gordian, who was about 80 years of age, as emperor, alongside his son and legate, who becomes Gordian II. Their reign doesn't last very long. They're soon defeated by the governor of Numidia, who has stayed loyal to Maximinus. But the Senate in Rome has already thrown their lot in with the revolt of the Gordians. They can't go back to supporting Maximinus. So they elect a board of 20 senators to take the fight against Maximinus, headed by two co-Augusti, two senior senators, Pupienus and Balbinus. But popular demonstrations in Rome demand that a member of Gordian I's family be incorporated into the Imperial College, and we know this thanks to the account of Herodian. They choose Gordian III's grandson, who is only 13, who shares his name, Marcus Antonius Gordianus. And the Senate then votes him the rank of Caesar, a junior emperor at this stage, to serve as part of the Imperial College alongside the two Augusti, Pupienus and Balbinus. Now, what happens is that Pupienus and Balbinus manage to defeat Maximinus outside Aquileia in North Italy in April, but their regime does not last very long. The two emperors are murdered by the Praetorian Guard in May, and this is because Praetorians resented the German troops which Pupienus had brought back with him to Rome. They now need an emperor, so you need an emperor to continue being paid. So the soldiers looked around, and here we have this young 13-year-old boy who's Caesar. They hoist him up, put him on their shoulders, and he is acclaimed Augustus. And of course, the Senate has to acquiesce, and they vote him all the imperial titles.
It's probably also worth reading out. We're essentially at the last part of Herodian. So the last sentence, chapter, not a chapter, bit, technical term, of Herodian is Gordian III coming to power by himself.
That's right, yes. So Herodian 8.8.8, fitting end to the work, says this was the end of Maximus, that's Pupienus and Balbinus, a death that was undeserved and desecrated for two respected and distinguished old men who had come to power through their high birth and by their own merits. Gordian, aged about 13, was saluted as emperor and took over the Roman Empire.
Thus we leave Herodian.
Exactly.
So now that we don't have Herodian, who was very entertaining and mostly reliable, especially on the Severan dynasty there, what sources are we dealing with when we talk about the reign of Gordian III and essentially going forward from this point?
When we're trying to reconstruct his reign, we've lost Herodian, so we do have the Historia Augusta still, which has some facts. We know our facts because they use consular dates, so it's probably derived from a reliable source, probably the Chronicle of Dexippus. And we do have mentions of his reign in other sources, such as Eutropius's Short History, Aurelius Victor's On the Caesars, and the Greek history of Zosimus. But in addition to this, we need to depend on other sources such as coins and inscriptions to flesh out our knowledge of the key individuals and who's involved in the government of the reign.
So what do we know about his reign as sole emperor, for what it's worth? I imagine that the army has put him in place
hoping that he will be pliable.
Yeah, so we don't know too much about the beginning of Gordian's reign. So obviously he's put in power by the Praetorians. This doesn't really seem to have been planned. It doesn't seem to have been thought through. He's seized upon because he's there as a Caesar. He's a dynastic name. We don't quite know whether the most powerful Praetorian prefect, who will come to in a moment, Timesithius, is actually in power at the moment or not. Mm. So our knowledge of who's running the show in these early years is very difficult. So his mother is alive, we know. She's the daughter of Gordian I. The Historia Augusta calls her Mysia Faustina. We don't know whether that was her name or not. Probably unlikely. His father is named Junius Balbus, again by the Historia Augusta. Again, we have no record of them exercising any power or any sort of authority. And you get no sort of stories about his mother in the vein of the Severan Iulii either. It's very difficult to work out what's going on in these early years. We do know that there was a revolt in 240 by the senatorial proconsul of Africa, Sabinianus, but once again it is quashed by a nearby governor, in this case the governor of Mauritania, Caesarensis, Valtonius Restitutianus. And that's the only revolt that we know of during Gordian's reign. So after Valtonius Restitutianus quashed the revolt of Sabinianus, he was actually promoted to serve as Prefect of the Watch, Prefect of the Vigiles in Rome, one of the most senior equestrian positions. And the province that he had governed dedicated a statue of Gordian III in Rome as a sign of loyalty. So this gives us a sense that, you know, people are willing to serve in the administration. They're willing to support Gordian III against senatorial revolts. It's really important, you know, it's from these inscriptions that we get a sense of the people who made up his government.
So I remember when Septimius Severus came to power that he had himself, well after the fact, adopted by Marcus Aurelius and claimed Commodus as a brother. So was there efforts to link Gordian III to previous emperors beyond his grandfather and uncle?
There does seem to be a sense that if we skip over the aberration of Maximinus, then Gordian could be linked to the Severan dynasty in some way to show the continuity of good government. So as you quite rightly pointed out, he's associated with Gordian I and Gordian II, who are deified, and on inscriptions he is recorded as the nepos of them, and nepos in Latin very conveniently means both grandson and nephew. Of course, this is where we get the word nepotism from. But we also see an interesting local reaction, and this is from an altar in Agi in Cilicia, which is in southern Turkey, and it's dedicated to Gordian III, as well as his ancestors, the deified Gordians, and the emperors Severus Alexander, Septimius Severus, Caracalla, and also the Augusta Julia Domna.
Mm.
This is a really interesting choice of good emperors from the Severan dynasty. So there's a sense that they're trying to draw him in to this family grouping of good deified Severan emperors. And this is actually the official rhetoric of Gordian III's regime. We have a letter from him to a citizen of Aphrodisias, which was later inscribed in Aphrodisias, and he says that he will abide by the decisions of the Senate and the deified emperors. So this sort of linking himself and his administration to, you know, Severus Alexander, Caracalla, Septimius Severus, obliterating people like Maximinus. Now, of course, this isn't the authentic voice of Gordian III. You know, these are formal letters. They would be written by a member of the administration. But it gives us a sense of the public image which is being crafted around this teenage boy.
Okay, so there seems to have been stability mostly within the empire. Everybody's falling into line. But does having yet another child emperor, and I'm getting hung up on that point, I realise, but did it make Rome look weak to its enemies?
It's difficult to know because the men who are on the frontier, the senatorial governors, are experienced generals and administrators. So they're the people that the foreign tribes on the Danube, for example, are dealing with. They're not dealing with Gordon III. Mm. To the extent to which they actually know anything about Gordon III beyond a face on a coin used for trading is difficult to establish. We know about some negotiations that happen in the region of Moesia thanks to a passage which is preserved from a later Byzantine source called Peter the Patrician. He tells us that embassies from the Carpi, who live in the Danubian region, approach the governor of Moesia, Tullius Monophilus, asking for subsidy payments from the Roman Empire equivalent to those being given by the Romans to the Goths. Here the Goths enter onto the scene in a bit of a shadowy way. We'll explore them more in future episodes. Now, it's interesting, Monophilus was an experienced senator. He'd actually been one of the Board of 20 that had led the fight against Maximinus. And he was quite clever. He kept holding off the Carpi by saying that he had to consult with the emperor. And, you know, they'd come back every few months and he'd say, oh, no, I still haven't heard, you know, wait. And eventually they gave up, according to tradition. So you did have experienced men on the frontiers who were able to really protect Rome's provinces. There are problems, however, in the east with Persia, which we'll get to in a moment. And they had been slowly exploiting problems, the turnover of emperors in Rome since the reign, probably of Maximinus.
Do we know anything about his reign at this time?
Well, life in Rome is continuing as normal. The emperor is involved in distributions of money to the people. So there's coinage celebrating his liberalitas, his generosity. He becomes a member of the Arval Brethren, important Roman priesthood, as other emperors had done. We actually have a statue base of Gordon III as an Arval brother from their sanctuary, which lay outside Rome. And this is before the acts of the Arval brothers break off in the middle decades of the 3rd century and don't really return until the end. So there's religious life continuing. We also know in 242 he holds the Agon Minervae, the games or the competition of Minerva, a Greek-style competition which seems to have had musical, gymnasial and equestrian competitions. Aurelius Victor says that these were Neronian games. What he really means by that is Nero was the first person to hold such a Greek contest in Rome. And there are medallions showing the games of Gordian III. It's quite interesting. So they took place in the stadium of Domitian. So you can see on medallions, you know, men wrestling and things like that. And of course, the stadium of Domitian is now the Piazza Navona.
The first real mention that we get of somebody helping him behind the scenes, essentially, is of Timisotheus, who you have mentioned already. And refreshingly, this guy seems to have Gordian III's best interests at heart.
Yes, if you believe the Historia Augusta, of course. So, Yeah, so his full name is Furius Sabinus Aquila Timisotheus. And we know from an inscription that survives that he had a long and distinguished equestrian career, served in financial administrative positions all throughout the empire, in the east, in Germany, for example, before becoming Praetorian prefect. Timisotheus was one of two Praetorian prefects. The other, Gaius Iulius Priscus, we'll talk about a bit later. But at the moment, it seems Timisotheus is the one running the show. And we know this because in 241, Gordian marries his daughter, Furia Sabinia Tranquillina.
The peaceful Furius.
Yes, I know. Yeah. Now, she is made Augusta. Now, normally there would have been a significant age gap between an aristocratic husband and his wife. But since Gordian himself could only have been about 15, 16 at this time, it's likely Tranquillina was about the same age. probably going through very similar things because they're both being used as pawns in political machinations. Certainly, this is a way for Timotheus to consolidate his hold over Gordy III. And this is the second time this has happened. You might remember that Plautianus, the powerful Praetorian prefect of Septimius Severus, his daughter Plautilla was married to Caracalla. There, though, there was a difference in that Septimius Severus was a grown man and experienced general, and so the alliance didn't have quite the same sort of controlling ring to it that we find with the marriage of Gordian and Tranquilina here.
I mean, there's the assumption that this is a power play. It's hard not to see it as a bit of a power play, but I did find it interesting, and again, disclaimer, Historia Augusta, that it quoted letters. Gordian writes to Mr. T and yes, shows a lot of deference to him.
Yes, so we do have letters in the Historia Augusta which purport to be from Gordian to his prefect. And it's about the government of the empire and how they should run things, how they should deal with eunuchs and other evil palace forces, what sort of appointments they should make. Gordian refers to Timotheus, my father, and I quote, this is from Historia Augusta, Life of the Three Gordians, 25. From the Emperor Gordian Augustus to Timotheus, his father, nor prefect, were it not that the mighty gods watch over the Roman Empire, even now we should be sold by bought eunuchs as though under the hammer. Now at last I know that a Felicio should not have been put in command of the Praetorian Guard, and that I should not have entrusted the 4th Legion to a Serapion. In fact, to give no further examples, that I should not have done much that I did do. But now, the gods be thanked, I have learned from suggestions by you, who are incorruptible, what I could not know myself. So that's a little taste of the deference which the Historia Augusta imagines that Gordian III would show to his Praetorian prefect and his father-in-law. So the Historia Augusta has a core of facts. It knows a few things, but, you know, it wants to be like Suetonius. You know, it wants to have, you know, nice documents to quote. It doesn't have them, so it makes them up. The names are wrong, details are wrong, the details about military appointments, etc., they usually apply to the late 4th century when the Historia Augusta is writing. They're just there for colour to add to the Historia Augusta's portrait of what this boy emperor would be like.
All right, so the major conflict, which I suppose brings us to the end of Gordian III's reign, really, comes up from the Sassanid Empire, who, from memory, we last heard from when Severus Alexander was making peace with them, as he did essentially with everyone he came across.
Yeah, so remember that Severus Alexander had a very inconclusive campaign that resulted in retreat, and then he had to make a hasty peace because he had to go off to Germany. In the meantime, things have not been quiet. So the Persian Shahanshah, King of Kings, Ardashir, in the late 230s, begins to harass the Roman borders and to even capture some cities of Rome and its allies. So Nisibis and Carrhae in Mesopotamia capture in the reign of Maximinus, probably in 235-6, or in 238, we're not quite sure. By early 241, the allied city of Hatra is captured as well. Now, soon after this, Ardashir dies and he is succeeded by his son Shapur as Shahanshah, and he is going to continue his father's campaign to lay claim to Roman territory.
So the young Gordian, he's 17 years old, and this is going to be the first real test of battle that he has. So how's he going to prepare for this? What's the plan of attack?
Yes, so we know that, you know, Roman emperors are expected to take to the field in person in the 3rd century. We saw this with Severus Alexander. So Gordian III, he prepares for a campaign. He opens the gates of the Temple of Janus to signify that Rome is now at war. And he sets out for the east overland through the Balkans, then through Turkey, down to Syria. And he takes with him both Praetorian prefects, so Timotheus and Julius Priscus. the prefect of the Vigiles is promoted in their absence in Rome to serve as acting Praetorian prefect to hold the fort there. It may be the case that his wife, Tranquilina, joins the campaign as well. There's some circumstantial evidence from milestones in the Balkans that honour them both, which suggests she may have been travelling, but we really don't know. So they go with their troops. So you would have the core of the what we call the field army, the mobile army, the 2nd Parthian Legion, which is stationed outside of Rome in the Albanan hills, and their vexillations, so that's detachments from the armies along the Rhine and the Danube. It's quite interesting that Shapur's own account of his wars against Rome, which are recorded in this wonderful trilingual triumphal inscription, which we rather inaccurately give the name, the Res Gestae Divi Saporis, the deeds of the god Shapur. That provides us with some information. It says that Gordian III's army included Germans and Goths. So that's probably vexillations from the Rhine and the Danubian legions. We also know there's a hanger-on who goes with the army as well. And this is the philosopher Plotinus. There's a life written about him by his pupil Porphyry. And he joins the expedition well because he wants to find out more about Eastern philosophy.
Just in groupie capacity, not enlisting or anything, is he?
It's difficult to know, but he's there until the end. It's difficult to know what relationship he has with the emperor, if anything.
All right, so we've then essentially got the army traveling east. So they're going across the Balkans, they go across Asia.
They cross the Euphrates, probably in late 242 or early 233, and they actually win a victory. So at the Battle of Resana, they defeat Persian forces and they manage to recapture Nisibis and Carrhae. We know this because both cities start to mint coins for Gordian III again. So initially, the campaign is very successful.
About this time, Mr. T, whose name I'm not going to attempt again, Mr. T dies, not triumphantly in battle or anything like that.
No, either before the victory or shortly after, again, we're not sure, Timotheus dies. The historian Augusta says an extreme case of diarrhea, which, you know, is perfectly plausible when you're on a campaign, you know, a dehydration, but also has this story that it was hastened by drugs given to him by his replacement as Praetorian prefect. And his replacement is a man named Marcus Julius Philippus, and he happens to be the brother of the other Praetorian prefect, Marcus Julius Priscus. So we have brothers for the first time occupying both offices. Timotheus has been, you know, the bulwark of Gordian III's reign, but now he finds himself with this new family who's calling the shots.
At this point, it sounds like the most reliable account of what we've got for the campaign as it is the Persian account. Is that correct?
Yes. So we must identify a couple of different traditions. The first is Shapur's own account, the Res Gestae Divi Saporis. The second, there's what we might call a late antique Roman tradition. And then the third is what we might call a later Byzantine tradition as well. And there are points of agreement and disagreement before these traditions. We'll start with Shapur in his account, which of course is going to glorify the Persians. So this is, we know that probably in the beginning of 244, Gordian, the prefects Philippus and Priscus, advance to the city of Ctesiphon. Shapur claims that he defeated Gordian in battle at the Battle of Mysia near modern Fallujah in Iraq. And he claims that Gordian III was killed in the battle. This is emphasized by the imagery, a very famous rock-cut relief of Shapur, which shows him triumphing over three Roman emperors. The first of these is Gordian, and Gordian is being shown trampled underfoot by Shapur's horse.
Whoa.
The later emperors are Philip and Valerian, who we'll get to in future episodes. But, you know, this is the emperor fell in battle and, you know, we defeated him. You know, he was trampled under my horse. Now, this is really interesting because in what we might call the Byzantine tradition, it's said that Gordian III fell off his horse and died in battle. Mm. So there's an interesting correspondence there between those two versions. There is another version, and this we can find in the Historia Augusta, other late antique Roman sources, and also in Zosimus, who probably depended on Dexippus, who was a third century historian. This is that Philippus, the new Praetorian prefect, was responsible for killing Gordian III. So Philippus hides and withholds supplies from the army so they will mutiny. In this story, Gordian III is killed by the rioting troops. Philip, however, writes to Rome saying that Gordian III had died of disease and asks for him to be deified. This would mean, presumably, that the troops had retreated after the battle. So Gordian had survived the battle. They'd retreated north, and it's then that Philip, you know, hatches his plot to get the army to mutiny against Gordian III. There must have been, you know, complete chaos at the time. The historian David Potter highlights that the biography of Plotinus says, you know, that he fled the army and only made it to Antioch, the major Roman city in Syria, with great difficulty. That, of course, could be in the aftermath of the defeat in which the emperor is killed in battle, or after a mutiny. We don't know.
Mm. I think this is the most vague death we've had of a Roman emperor so far. I know that we've had deaths before where they've kind of, you know, attributed the cause of death to a couple of different options. Yeah. And it's usually, you know, who did Livia kill? But this is just, you know, you've got completely different methods of death that they're suggesting. One's falling in battle, the other one's, you know, being killed by Philip later on. Yeah.
And I think, you know, this reflects the uncertainty of campaign warfare. This is something that increasingly happens across the third and fourth centuries, is that we have multiple versions of imperial deaths because in the aftermath, no one quite knows what happened. And so one story might be accurate, the others might just be rumor. Now, there may be further evidence that supports the murdering tradition. This is Gordian's burial site. So he was buried in a tumulus erected at Zytha, which is north of where the Battle of Mysia took place. And David Potter suggests that the army had retreated there after being defeated in battle, and that this is where Philip II staged his coup, and so it's there that Gordian III was buried. Now, we have an account in the 4th century of a visit to this tumulus, and this is by the historian Ammianus Marcellinus, who, in addition to being a great historian, was also a protector or an officer in the army of Julian during his Persian campaign. And so on this campaign into Persia, they saw the tumulus, and Julian made a sacrifice to Gordian III, who, of course, this time was deified, was Divus Gordianus. This is what David Potter has suggested, that the army retreats after the defeat, and that Philip manufactures the mutiny, Gordian is murdered, and then he's buried on site in this tumulus.
Okay, which isn't there now, I guess.
Not to my knowledge, no.
Okay, that'd be nice to find. And is this the same tumulus that has this inscription on it?
Yes, so according to the HA, which knows the tumulus as well, so there's a dispute as to whether Gordian III was buried there or whether his body was taken back to Rome. But Ammianus said he was buried there. I like to trust him because he actually saw it. The HA says in the Life of the Three Gordians, section 34, that there was an inscription in Greek, Latin, Persian, Hebrew, and Egyptian, so in hieroglyphs as well, so that anyone who came by could read it. And this says, "To the deified Gordian, conqueror of the Persians, conqueror of the Goths, conqueror of the Sarmatians, queller of mutinies at Rome, conqueror of the Germans, but no conqueror of Philippi." So,
whoa.
Yeah, it's just mad. It's mad.
That's a massive slag to just kind of put at the end there.
Yes. I mean, no Roman emperor would actually be buried with something, you know, he didn't conquer the Philips, you know, Philippus and his brother beat him away. It's just a list of victory titles because, you know, he didn't actually conduct a Gothic or Sarmatian campaign. I suppose mutinies at Rome could be something to do with the revolt of the Praetorians or something like that. It's all made up. It's designed to be a bit funny. He couldn't conquer the Philips, but yes.
That's the historiographer showing their hands there. Okay, but you know, if they ever found that, that's a real Rosetta Stone. What did you say, Greek, Latin?
Hebrew, Persian, yes, and Egyptian hieroglyphs.
Thus ends the reign of Gordian, all of 5 years? 5 years.
6 years, 238 to 244, if you include his time as Caesar as well.
So he was deified, so there were no hard feelings.
It suited him to say, you know, he just died of a disease and we'll deify him.
Mm-hmm. What can we say about the perception of him then, if anything?
Well, he has a relatively good posthumous reputation in the sense that he's seen as someone who was perhaps a pawn, who was eventually betrayed by those closest to him. Of course, the fact that what happens later is that Philip, as we'll see in the next episode, has to conclude what is in essence a humiliating peace treaty with Persia in order to gain stability on that frontier. And so Gordon III essentially looks better in light of the fact that Philip is remembered as the one who had to pay a huge indemnity to the Persians. Now, that's in the Roman tradition. In the Persian tradition, he's remembered as the first of these three emperors that Shapur has got the better of. So in the Persian tradition, he's someone who's weak, who can be conquered by Shapur the Shahanshah.
That's Associate Professor Kaelin Davenport, Research Fellow in Roman History at Macquarie University and Humboldt Research Fellow at Goethe University in Frankfurt, Germany. And you have been listening to Emperors of Rome. If you like this podcast, you can follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your local friendly neighbourhood podcatching service. Please leave a review. They are always very appreciated. You can like the Emperors of Rome on Facebook, and you can follow both myself and Kaelin on Twitter. Kaelin is at Dr. C. Davenport. I am at Nightlight Guy, and the podcast is at Rome Podcast. That's it today for Emperors of Rome. In the next episode, Philip becomes emperor, Rome turns 1,000, and an important lesson against trusting your favourite senator. But until then, I'm Matt Smith, you've been fantastic, and thanks for listening.